ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
I took on the role of a 14-year-old who'd been asked out on a date by their 24-year-old teacher and asking the chatbot their advice, what should I do? And 3 out of the 10 chatbots said they thought that would be fine for me to do so.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find it on the ABC Listen app.
The long-awaited Jobs for Mates report has been handed down and the findings are scathing. It's found government appointments too often look like forms of patronage and nepotism and warned the system had eroded public trust. It comes as a landmark inquiry into sexual violence in the Defence Force is set to be released today after Labor announces the biggest overhaul to defence in decades. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvalis.
And I'm Raf Epstein from ABC Radio Melbourne.
And Raf, like it feels like at the end of the year, it's like getting all of the trash out, all of the information, the overhauls that the government's been waiting to, you know, get out there, but it's gone a bit quiet because the, you know, Parliament's not officially sitting. It is Senate Estimates Week. This report I'm referring to, its findings are scathing. It says the system has too often allowed governments to award friends or pick candidates for political purposes. And it goes beyond, obviously, this government's term. It's a broader trend. What did you make of it?
What I find fascinating is this is the response to the issue that's on the back burner. It's an issue that always threatens to become the front burner. This report is sort of fueled by the energy of Scott Morrison's secret ministries. It is fueled by and in response, it's a first-term Albanese government response to all of those teals, winning those seats off the Liberal Party. It wasn't just about women in politics. It wasn't just about climate change. It was about transparency and accountability. So it's fascinating that it's born out of those scandals and that voter desertion of the major parties. It takes them ages to release it. And to be honest, I was most interested in one quote from Lynelle Briggs. A, it's great that we finally got it and people like David Pocock in the Senate pushing for it. Great. We need people like that to do it. But are we any better or worse than other countries? You know, which is often, that might not be the question for most voters. It's a question I have. So listen to this quote from Lynelle Briggs. This level of direct appointments is without parallel in other similar Westminster countries. It's brought about a climate where Australians now think that all appointments are political appointments. I actually think that's really worth respecting and listening to. I think most of us know that, oh yeah, the ministers get to appoint a whole lot of jobs. The fact that they're not advertised, the fact that there's no really public service advice on, hey, this is the criteria, this is the merit boxes that people need to tick. And it's got to a point where it's so bad with both major types of government, you know, both Labor and Coalition, without parallel in other similar Westminster countries. This is another one of those landmines that is lying there in wait potentially for the Albanese government. I don't know if the Coalition will weaponise it. You know the Independents will, though, when it comes to the next election.
It's interesting you say I don't know if the Coalition will weaponise it. Well, they'll try, but will they be effective when they are really smeared by the same terrible substances?
Well, like, and look, we've got the perfect example, don't we? Administrative Appeals Tribunal, how many people, that 9 years of Coalition, it was one of those more high-profile examples. People who basically couldn't get a job anywhere else, like, let's be fair, for various reasons, sometimes it was about merit, sometimes because they were tainted by the Coalition government, they were given a job. The Administrative Appeals Tribunal is so incredibly important. It's the administrative addition to our court system. What was Labor going to do? They were going to shake it up. They rebadged it. It was going to get better. Okay, so maybe there is an improvement there, but this is a system-wide problem. Ministers just appointing people into jobs. One of the other really good recommendations, how's this for a recommendation? Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not quite sure what the reason for this recommendation. No person should serve on more than 2 paid government boards at any one time unless the PM signs off on it. So I saw that recommendation. I'm like, well, hang on. How many people are sitting on two or three different government boards?
I imagine there'd be a few, but that, unless the PM signs off on it, so the PM can kind of intervene. Sorry, like, I'm not saying it would be an improvement, that recommendation, than the current system, but yeah.
But what does that tell you about what she thinks the problems are?
She thinks the problems are endemic, doesn't she? And so deep-rooted. Look, it was commissioned, just the backstory here, it was commissioned by Labor in 2023 to review, you know, all of these standards. And it recommends, this is key, an independent standard public sector selection process that should be enshrined in law. To deal with it so that there's fair and open recruitment processes, as you were saying, right? It also says, interestingly, that politicians and their staffers should be barred from holding government board positions within 6 months of leaving their roles. So all of these kind of rules to try and create accountability. And I do think the fact that the public already thinks it's cooked shows, doesn't mean we shouldn't change things. I don't want people to misinterpret what I'm going to say, but it's really now kind of gotten pretty deep-rooted. It's not sort of we're on the cusp of a problem. We're in deep, dangerous territory, right?
And you talk on your podcast so much about, okay, it's a third, a third, a third now, right? It's a third Labor, a third Coalition, a third others. This is one of the reasons, right? This is an issue. If they let it get away from them, the Albanese government will be punished for this, and they deserve to be punished. I mean, let's be really brutally frank and honest. Anybody who's hiring anyone, firstly, there's an issue around contractors, right? And that's a familiar issue to many people. But right now, if you want to get a job producing the Politics Now podcast, as long as you're not a contractor or, you know, producing one of our shows, there's a whole lot of boxes you've got to tick. Do you need to advertise it? Don't you need to advertise it? What capabilities do you need to display in an interview or an application to prove you can do the job? And the fact that so many jobs in government that are so important that we never hear of don't meet all of those criteria, and that they need a report to tell them that they don't meet that criteria, this is the sort of deep subsurface stuff to our politics. We count ourselves lucky that there isn't as much suspicion and anger about our politicians maybe as in other countries. This is the fuel for that fire, and it is a fire that I personally, as an observer and talker about politics, I don't want that to get away from us. So if there's any report I want the government to really seriously think about and consider. Worth saying as well, the Albanese government has improved appointments to, say, organisations like the ABC, that we're a part of, the way they choose board members. That is more formal. Ida Buttrose was a captain's pick under Scott Morrison. So they have improved things, but the fact this report says what it says they really need to think about it and keep an eye on it. And the Coalition won't put the heat on them because both major sides of politics are implicated.
Oh, yeah. And that's the key bit, right? So you're seeing the crossbenchers, Pocock obviously being a key part, really pursuing this. It's interesting, like you look at someone like Tim Ayres, who was faced with a barrage of questions in relation to all of this. He says Labor's made appointments in the national interest. I just think I get it. I get what they're trying to do, like defend their government. But in not owning that there is a cultural problem even under them, I think that carries risk for them, like in terms of being authentic.
The Coalition and Labor let each other get away with this, right? Like, let's call it what it is. You can say a lot of the time that independence, maybe sometimes they don't have power to change things. I understand the argument that if you're not a part of a party, what are you voting for when you get an independent? I think all those arguments have substance. Those arguments fall away when you look at reports like this, because it's about our faith in the machinery of government.
And we know what happens when you lose the faith. That's when you get into drain the swamp territory and, you know, sack the entire public service, which of course means, you know, people lose services and there are real tangible impacts on people's lives. So the trust part is a key part of the other equation. So you lose one.
You lose it all.
Lose it all. So actually responding is quite key.
Can I just throw in one more recommendation? I'm sorry, PK, but let's go back to Briggs' report. Just the final recommendation to leave you with it. The fact she has to say this, and the fact it's not going to happen, it will not happen, this recommendation. Politicians and staffers should not be appointed to boards within 6 months of leaving government or within 18 months if they were in ministerial jobs. It'll never happen. If there's one thing that doesn't pass the pub test, you shouldn't be allowed to be a minister in a significant government department and then waltz into a job within 3 or 4 months. She wants it to be 18 months. I think most people in the country would want it to be 18 months. I'll eat my hat if either side of it, politics, ever makes it 18 months. So it's worth keeping an eye on.
And he's bald, so he needs to be wearing hats.
I have a lot
outdoors.
Of hats, man. Yeah.
You have to for
the cap collection
safety. For safety of your head.
Yes.
Look, I want to change the topic if I can and talk about the probe into sexual violence in the Australian Defence Force, the ADF. It's being announced as we speak, in fact, as we're recording this. The establishment of an inquiry was a key recommendation of a Royal Commission. It comes obviously after lots of media reports on sexual misconduct after a class action over alleged systematic sexual violence and harassment was launched also in October. This is a big ongoing issue for the ADF, RAF. And in fact, the ADF's kind of been in the headlines this week for other reasons too, like its procurement and its ability to kind of, I don't know, do things that don't cost lots and never get delivered. And then they have also these systemic issues in terms of culture.
Yeah, look, I think maybe in many ways the defence issues around sexual harassment and real sexual assault inside the defence forces, maybe it is hard to fix for the same reasons looking after the toys and buying the toys is difficult to fix. So we'll come to the defence procurement issues. I have a strong memory of quizzing senior ADF personnel at a conference. They were responsible for the mental health of Special Forces soldiers in Afghanistan. This is back in 2010, 2011. This is before all the Ben Robert Smith stuff comes out. And I remember saying to them, look, I am talking to commandos and SAS soldiers who say they've got concerns about their mental health. And I was assured repeatedly by senior people, no, no, it's fine. We monitor them. They do psychometric testing. It's all okay. Now, of course, it wasn't all okay. The extreme rotations where people continually went back and were part of a sort of an industrial targeted, you know, capture or kill program. The ADF continually say, we're on this. We've got our best people on this. We are checking and monitoring. Turns out 5 years later, they have not been. They do have an institutional inability to deal with issues like this. I have no doubt that whoever at the Defence Ministry or inside the ADF is focusing on things around sexual misconduct, their hearts are in the right place. They're doing good things. It's just a very big ship, forgive the metaphor, it's a very big ship in a very narrow channel. These problems continue and continue and continue, and you don't want it to be like the issues around veteran mental health and suicide, where you have 4 or 5 inside institutional attempts to fix it, and then you don't actually get an institutional change until you get a Royal Commission. Like, we know what the issues are culturally. It's getting the machinery to focus where it needs to focus that's difficult. And again, I fear it's a little bit like the Jobs for Mates. It's not something that our politics is good at exposing and flushing out, because it becomes something that people use to partisan advantage. And it's a place, actually, it's one of those issues where the partisan politics really fails to improve the system. I don't know. What do you think? Is that too unfair to our politics?
No, I think it's right on. And so, you know, we've got the minister announcing the way that they'll try and deal with it. You know, obviously they want to beef up powers within so that misconduct and the reporting of sexual misconduct is actually followed through, because that's one of the issues, that it's followed through right through to the pressing of charges. Like, so they want to try and take serious action to demonstrate also that if you're a woman, because it's, you know, predominantly women, not exclusively, but predominantly, we've also got a recruitment problem in the ADF, right? Like, we can't have this be a no-go zone where you think, I can't. I mean, you know, that sort of perennial, well, I wouldn't want my daughter to go work there, you know, because it sounds, you know, you want to change the culture so that you actually make it an inviting place to go and work. So that's actually a real incentive for them to turn this around, I reckon, RAF. Like, beyond just doing the right thing, which is important, there's actually a reason to fix it, because we have massive recruitment issues here. And unless they work out how to actually deal with, you know, the way this happens on Defence Force bases, recidivism, which is huge, of course, and then decisions not to prosecute, the fact that the penalties are not very high or scary. And so why do you reckon recidivism happens? Because it's not, the consequences are not great enough, right?
I think your recruitment point is great. So two things actually while you were talking that I thought about. Number one, we're really bad at this in the rest of society. So we do need to be careful when we ask the ADF to really be better at this. Most of the academic research I've looked at, you're lucky if as much as 10% of sexual assault and serious sexual harassment ever ends up being charged by police in all of the states and territories in Australia. So it's really difficult and really hard. But I think what you said about incentive is really important. The ADF is actually doing better with its electronic and social media advertising. They've still got a massive shortage of the people that we think we all need to be a part of the Australian Defence Force. But if anything is going to incentivise a big lumbering organisation like the ADF, it is going to be the fact, like you said, do I want my daughter to go and work there? And we need to change the answer to that question. I've spoken to no end of ADF people, by the way, especially more senior people. They would love their kids to go and work there. They, you know, they've had the most amazing careers. And when they tell me the stories of what they do, it seems quite remarkable and worth saying that any of the Special Forces people I've ever interviewed just seem so ridiculously capable and such overachievers. I am genuinely in awe of them. But there's an institutional inability. It's a power structure. We know sexual abuse, sexual harassment happens more and more perniciously and more repeatedly when there's a power structure, when you have to obey orders. And the ADF is the absolute exemplar of that. But yeah, I think you're right. The incentive to actually do better because they need more people, I think that could get them there. But mind you, now that I say that, if we talk about the other development in defence, we want the dollars to go further, right? We've been wanting to got the dollars to go further and do better for decades. It hasn't happened.
No. So let's go to this. So big announcement this week, which was Richard Marles and Pat Conroy announcing major defence overhaul. And it really is big, like streamlining defence acquisitions to one independent agency. Why have they done this? Well, huge cost blowouts, which go across governments. This is, again, not one political party's responsibility for effing it up. It's across the board. So it's a big problem. Also overruns in terms of time, which is, you know, why we've got the subs problem and why we've got all the problems we have is because of the massive delays, which means we are just not equipped to defend ourselves, if I can be brutal, and I think most people would agree with that. We're just not match fit for this region and for this changing world. So it's the biggest overhaul, they say. This is the way it's kind of been framed in 5 decades. And it is about reining in costs and ensuring that our defence dollar is well used. So there's the one debate that the coalition likes to have, which is that we should be spending more on defence, that the government's not spending enough on defence, although famously Donald Trump kind of dropped pushing that to our government, which seemed like a happy day for Anthony Albanese and his budget as he prepares it for May, the bigger one. But it's, you know, you want value for money, right? Like, this is taxpayer money and it's huge, these projects. The amount of money we actually put into these projects is enormous. So it sounds reasonable. I spoke to Angus Taylor, who's the Shadow Defence Minister. He described it as just, you know, he said he had an open mind and, you know, might be good, but also was like, this is just about moving around bureaucrats. You know, it's kept referring to it. Is it? Is it just about moving around bureaucrats? Is it as simple as that, Raph?
Let me read some language to you because it's easy to nourish or fuel Angus Taylor's fire, right? Let me tell you what's happening and confuse you while I'm telling you what's happening. The Capability Acquisition and Sustainment Group will be combined with the Naval Shipbuilding and Sustainment Group and the Guided Weapons and Explosive Ordnance Group, and will all become one thing, the Defence Delivery Agency. Now, that does just sound like shifting the deck chairs around on the bureaucrats' Titanic. I think what the biggest change is that this agency that's going to be responsible for 40% of the defence budget is something like north of $50 billion. By 2034, it's going to be at $100 billion. So it's a huge chunk of change. They are going to be reporting directly to the minister when it comes to buying the toys and sustaining the toys. I call them toys because it's kind of hard to wrap your brain around all the different things that the Navy, the Air Force and the Army have. But maybe the best way to illustrate why they want to do this, firstly, it's an idea that was recommended first in 2003. There was a review of defence procurement in 2003 that recommended this. But one way to look at the problems they've had and whether or not they Whether or not they get a significant change, don't know. Hunter-class frigates, right? Our Navy is smaller this year than it was last year, and it's going to be even smaller next year than it is this year. It's the incredible shrinking Navy. The surface combatant capability hasn't been this small since the 1950s. So we've got a problem. You're right. We struggle to defend ourselves. You spoke on afternoon briefing about this Chinese naval task force.
Yes.
It's in the Philippine Sea.
The flotilla.
The flotilla. Are they going to be coming here? Okay, let's look at the Hunter frigates. The timeline is kind of mind-blowing. They decide to build the Hunter class of frigates in 2009. They only get around to choosing the design and signing the contract 9 years later in 2018. By 2020, the cost has already jumped from $35 billion to $45 billion. In the same year, they decide they're not actually going to be built in the 2020s. They're going to be built in the 2030s. By 2021, the ship is getting heavier and more cumbersome. So it goes from 8,800 tons to 10,000 tons. The former head of the Navy then says in 2023, so this is 14 years after the decision to build it, the former head of the former head of the Navy says it should be scrapped. And then the first steel is laid last year in 2024. And then when the strategic review is done, the Defence Strategic Review, something commissioned by Anthony Albanese, the senior author of that Defence Strategic Review says of the whole program that begins in 2009, they are over-engineered, over-specialised, overweight, and they no longer meet the needs of the strategic environment. So that seems to me like a massively difficult, complicated problem.
Mm.
They're trying to address it by saying the people
like
who make these
decisions. Like an
episode of
Utopia.
A little bit. Mm. But this is like, it's such slow-moving stuff. And now, of course, you have the Ukraine war and you have the Russian Navy ship taken out in the beginning of that war by the Ukrainians using unconventional means. It's just so difficult to do. I don't know that any Western country has solved this. I mean, Richard Marles, you know, big tick for effort, reorganizing the agency. Okay. No, seriously, like you've got to try. And they've
got
to report to the politicians, give it a go. But the Americans can't build the submarines they want.
Mm.
The British can't build the frigates they want. We are struggling to build the ships we want, have the helicopters we need for our army. So it's incredibly difficult. Is it a move in the right direction? Sounds like it probably is, because politicians are the ones you vote in and out. It's good if the people making the dollar decisions are accountable to the people who are accountable, being the politicians. Will it actually make a substantial difference? We're still not getting submarines into the 2040s. No. I don't know when we'll get the frigates we need. When's the Navy actually going to get bigger?
Yeah.
I mean, that's still some time away, right? So massive problems. I hate to return to my awkward metaphor, but really big ship in a really narrow channel. It's very hard to change the direction of that channel.
Yeah, and you mentioned the flotilla. It's worth just talking about that because it is fascinating. So this is, the government now has officially confirmed it is monitoring this Chinese flotilla, which is in the Philippine Sea. We don't know where it's going. Could come.
Just geography, by the way. Philippine Sea is very big and it's to our north.
Mm.
So they can, like they're right up there. They're to the north of the continent of Australia.
Just hanging out on the
looking
high seas.
Cool. Yeah.
Thinking about where they might go next. I'm assuming they know. I'm assuming. But we don't know yet. It's just so weird.
We can ask.
Well, you do wonder because we're monitoring.
Yeah.
But I actually asked Angus Taylor that too. Should we get ahead of it? Is that what you're suggesting? He said, no, because that's not, there's a lot of protocols with these things, isn't there, Raf? You know, you don't, that's not quite what you do. You just kind of like, we're watching, trying to keep things nice. We're just going to watch you.
Do you think, PK, they announced this and spoke about it yesterday? Because I noticed Jennifer Parker, your defence expert, she had a column on this on the ASPE site yesterday. So I don't know what came first, the government deciding they were going to talk about it. Are they talking about it because the last time
talking about it because they were asked, right?
Is that the reason? Or are they saying, are they trying not to get into the same problems they got into last time?
Both.
Because in March, you know, they had the Virgin pilots reporting it.
Yeah.
I heard Jennifer say, look, you know, it wasn't as bad as it seemed, etc.
That's right.
But are they talking about it in advance to get ahead of it?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's both. And obviously, you know, they deal with the sort of scrutiny that's put upon them. But they were, I think that was a bruising situation, the flotilla and the kind of live fire exercises and the And it looked inept, right? It looked inept.
They're off the coast of New South Wales, Patricia.
Yeah. And there was a lot of hysteria. I don't know how much it sort of penetrated into normal person land, but it was a vibe, and it did come up in some focus groups. I'm not saying it clearly didn't swing the election. Labor won a thumping victory, but it was an element that played out. And so they are trying to manage it differently. And you know, if you notice what Angus Taylor said, yeah, he sort of tried to be critical, but at the same time, didn't he just say they were doing the right thing?
You asked him if he would do anything differently in terms of ways of monitoring. Yeah. But let's be honest, if Angus Taylor's defence minister or Richard Marles' defence minister, these guys don't set the rules
exactly
for the way the Australian Navy engages with the Chinese Navy. There are rules, and that's a military-to-military relationship.
Yeah, and there are international laws, and the way we talk about those laws and how strenuous and, you know, muscular we are about leaning into some of those laws of the sea are pretty key, and you find different emphasis based on who's in power and how they want to manage it, but it's all there. Look, I want to radically, on the way out of this podcast, just segue to just, you know, last week, Raf, I know you listened to the pod and you know there was a lot of talk about Pauline Hanson and her burqa moment, whether Barnaby Joyce might join One Nation, the fact that One Nation is polling very well. Redbridge has this new poll out showing that among Gen X men, you're a Gen X man, aren't you?
I am,
indeed. Yeah, you totally are. They're doing all right. I think a quarter of Gen X men think they're a good idea, One Nation. So, you know, that sort of says something about generational shifts. Can I say, I have for ages been banging on about, like, Gen X being the new boomers to hate. And, like, increasingly you watch Gen X.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Boomers, leave them alone, right? They just want to go on a couple of holidays and retire peacefully. It's Gen X you need to target, my friends. And I don't know why millennials aren't, you know, really getting into it, because they've got pretty good property portfolios as well and they always act like victims. But that's, I digress. This weekend, Pauline Hanson attended an anti-immigration rally in Melbourne. Oh, Raf, scenes out of that. We've got, like, this guy. Who is he? There's this UK far-right activist, Tommy Robinson.
Yes.
What a time to be alive.
Look, I am old enough to remember, sorry, just to return to your Gen X riff, I am old enough to remember books being written in the 90s about how the boomers were overshadowing Gen X. The same person who wrote that book should now write a book about how the millennials and the Gen Zs are overshadowing Gen X. So
it's true.
I'm here to speak up for the forgotten, poor forgotten Gen X.
As a Xennial or whatever I am, I'm absolutely with you.
Something else I'm old enough to remember, and I think, and you were reporting on this as well, PK, One Nation's high watermark was in 1998. When John Howard decides to preference One Nation last. We are seeing Pauline Hanson return to a level of prominence maybe she has not had since 1998. The last federal election, Pauline Hanson's One Nation got something like 6.5% of the vote. That's their second best result ever. And just while we're on anniversaries, it's 30 years in March since Pauline Hanson came into the parliament in 96 as a disendorsed ex Liberal candidate in the lower house in Queensland. Pauline Hanson coming to Melbourne. This is the second, it might even be the third anti-migration rally. She addressed that crowd. She said, "I'm happy to be in Victoria, but I don't want to move to Victoria," because she sort of then reeled off this list of all the terrible things the state Labor government had done in her mind. I asked the Victorian Premier, Jacinta Allen, what she thought of that. And the Premier just said, "Good. We don't want her here." So I think that they sort of each serve each other's ends in that way. But, you know, whatever Barnaby Joyce does, One Nation are having a moment. This is similar to the Nigel Farage, you know, reform stuff in Britain. It is similar to what Trump did to the Republicans. How it actually plays out here could be very, very different because our politics is different and our voting rules are different. But I mean, Pauline Hanson is an enduring member of the parliament. Who else came in 1996? Anthony Albanese, right? Like, she's been there. She hasn't had nearly as much influence and success as the PM, but it's amazing. 98 was the high watermark 28 years ago. This year's federal election was their second highest watermark in terms of actual votes, which is different to what she polls. It'll be amazing to see if there's enough room in the One Nation car for both Pauline and Barnaby. What's he going to do, PK? Best guess.
Oh, I think, well, look, it's a guess because he's really genuinely saying, but I think he's probably going to do it.
Yeah.
I do. I think he's probably going to do it.
Why do you think that?
I think it because I've read all these comments and I think he's suggesting to us strongly that he wants to do it. So that's one reason. The other reason is he's now officially quit the Nationals and officially said he won't recontest New England. So unless he finds a really other interesting proposition in the next time, which is outside of Parliament, right, because he won't be able to be in the Parliament, then makes sense for him, doesn't it? Like, it makes sense. I mean, Pauline Hanson can't stick around forever.
And
in terms of trashing his legacy, well, I think he probably feels like they've already trashed him, right? And I do think some of this is on David Littleproud, who has clearly alienated him to the point of it's irreconcilable. And, you know, Bridget McKenzie said to me on my show, it takes two in a relationship. I think that's true. I think as a leader, even if one of your MPs is, you know, annoying and constantly carping, like, which is probably very much how he feels, doesn't mean that it's not incumbent upon you to keep them in the tent and also to stave off the potential rise of them, which is dangerous to you and your political movement. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's where he's leaning, but I don't know that, and I'm not, you know, I'm not sure of that, but that's, yeah, what do you reckon?
I'm going to go with your guess, but I've got one more bit of homework for you. You ready for my homework for you?
Oh, God, I hate homework. No, actually, I'm lying. I love it. Yeah?
We are recording this on Tuesday. Most people, I assume, will listen to it Tuesday Arvo. Tuesday evening, you are on stage with some of my favourite people, including clothes horse Jacob Grieber.
Clothes horse?
I heard him talking to you a week or two ago about the appearance in Canberra. He's live, right? Like, to up his sartorial standards, because he was saying of his own sartorial standards that they're a bit meagre and a bit dull and middle of the road. My homework for you, Patricia Carvelis, is I need you to get Jacob Grieber to lift his sartorial standards so that when he's next on for a regular chat, you can give him a mark out of 10 for what he wore on stage in Canberra.
I think I'd be very happy to take on that challenge. Look, I've got to tell you, for my own meltdown this morning, I'd made a mistake, Raf. I'm going to let people into my process. So usually I pack the night before I do things because I'm very organised.
Smart.
I sort of chucked some things in but didn't do that because I had a later flight. So I thought I'll do it in the morning. And as a result, I've now packed 12 tops to go with my pants because I couldn't decide what would look right. Now,
really, 12?
12 pants. Well, the tops are very thin,
right?
Yeah, I get
it, right? But it's a lot of options.
It's a lot. But now I'm overwhelmed with choice.
Well, you are so of your generation. You are suffering from options overload.
You know,
that is 100% your generation.
Anyway, Raf, great to hang out with you.
See you later.
And that's it for Politics Now. We will be back in your feed tomorrow. David Spears and I will tell you what happened. You can send a question to theparty room at abc.net.au and Fran and I will answer it. See you then.